I'm David Schreiner Khan, and this is Smashing the Plateau. No matter how successful you are, there's probably at least one area where roadblocks are keeping you from fully achieving your goals. Fortunately, you've come to the right place. Every expert I interview on this podcast is different, but they all have one thing in common. They know how to fix problems that keep people stuck. Would you like to learn how to minimize the most common risks associated with doing business on the internet? Join our free Smashing the Plateau community, where listeners and guests of Smashing the Plateau connect, collaborate, and learn how to smash the plateau in business, work, and in life. Go to smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook to join now. That's www.smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook. Today, I'm pleased to welcome Richard Chapo. Richard is a business lawyer in San Diego. With 20-plus years of experience, Richard helps businesses traverse the minefield of laws and regulations associated with operating online, including copyright, privacy, and FTC affiliate disclosure requirements. Richard, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, David.
Let's start off by talking a little bit about your personal story. I know you and I have chatted previously, and I know you have quite a remarkable story about how you smashed the plateau.
Sure. I came out of college at a fairly young age, like most people, and immediately went into law school. This would have been about 1988, and managed to get through the 3 years, graduate, and pass the California bar exam. And at that point, I was, I think 25 or so, and immediately moved into what's known as a boutique litigation firm. And what we did was we worked in complex areas of law, whether they be factual, such as wrongful death cases, we defend doctors and hospitals, and contractual, involving insurance, an area called bad faith insurance. And the purpose of that was essentially helping people get coverage when their insurance companies are rejected and what have you. Long, complex litigation cases, and it was the typical attorney life where you work 70, 80 hours a week. And, it's a high stress environment, but also interesting intellectually. So I did that. And, I think the unique thing from my experience was starting at 25 was, I think looking back on life, nobody's really sure what they want to be doing at 25, or at least most people aren't. I thought I did. But as time passed, it kind of became apparent to me that I really didn't. So after about 7 years, I was suffering serious burnout in about 1999 and decided to take a sabbatical for a year. And I actually went to Russia and taught at a university in Siberia for a year. And it gave me a chance to kind of reset and think about both my qualifications and, the typical career track for an attorney and whether I was comfortable with that or not. And being in Siberia, I didn't have a television or anything of that sort. So there was a lot of free time. I realized that really what mattered to me was kind of the work-life balance, the ability to, not work 70 hours a week, and also to work with clients where I felt like I was actually helping them build something instead of, tearing it down or avoiding it being turned down. Litigation tends to be, a destructive mechanism. And so more of the planning and that type of front. So when I came back, I had a friend who had become CEO of an internet company. And you have to remember, this is the year 2000, and most people are still on dial-up at that point. Mm-hmm. And there weren't a lot of attorneys practicing in the area. And so I got into it and, started learning all the different areas. But I was able to establish a work-life balance that was much happier with, much more sane, much less stress. And I tend to work with small businesses that are trying to grow. My purpose with it is really to be proactive with them and to try to protect them from potential risks, so that they can focus on their growth, while I take care of the risk side of it, make sure they, have insurance in place and that kind of a thing. And I've just found it to be much more rewarding, and I've stuck with it for the last, 17 years now. And so it was a major change. And, the plateau for me was really, busting out of the typical career attorney situation. A lot of attorneys, they wake up at 60 years old, or they've had a heart attack by then or whatever, and realize life has flown by and, now what? So I was really, really happy to get out of that. And that was kind of my change.
Yeah, that's great. And it's great. Congratulations that you were able to do it, because making such a change couldn't have been easy. Taking time out and going to teach in Siberia is quite a shift from litigation in California.
Yes, it was. It was, you know, the other thing about it was being involved in an entirely different culture. I didn't speak any Russian when I went, and the city I was in was called Chita, and there had been very few people there from outside of Russia because it was a closed city during communism, meaning they did weapons development. There was a lot of military there. So it was submersion in a completely new culture, and everything was different. But ultimately, you know, I certainly realized that, you know, people are the same all around the world, you know. Yeah, people are people, good and bad. But it was definitely, you know, a major reset button, if you will. It was, you know, nothing like San Diego where I'd grown up and was working.
Hey, Richard, were you forcing yourself to find something that was about as completely different as possible in order to make sure that the reset button took hold?
You know, I was definitely looking at the reset button. I think the issue for me was I was so stressed out. And so, you know, a lot of attorneys, you know, suicide, alcoholism, and drug abuse, you know, those are reflections of the stress level. And, you know, I was 7 years into it. I felt like I was, you know, so at that time I was probably about 32, 33. I felt like I was about 53. And, you know, just really kind of realized that I had gone completely off the track of where, you know, I needed to be personally. And I was pretty desperate, to be honest. And so it was just a break. And I don't think at the time I was thinking about it so much as a reset as I was just thinking about, you know, I need a break from this. And, you know, it gave me that opportunity. And then, you know, for a couple of months, kind of decompressed. And then after that, started thinking about, okay, well, you know, when I go back to the States, what am I going to do? You know, what are the things that I enjoy? What are the things that I don't enjoy? And of those things I don't enjoy, you know, how much of them are just part of life and how much of them can I actually, you know, move out of my, you know, career path and what have you. And so it was an evolution. So, you know, I definitely ended up with the reset. And, you know, looking back on it now, it's pretty obvious what I was trying to do. But at the time, I'm not sure I had a cognitive thought that way. It was scary. As an attorney, there's really only one major career path that you follow, regardless of whether you're in government or whatever, you're trying to move up to become a partner or something of that sort. And, you know, so it's often hard to think outside of that and see that there are other options, although, there clearly are. So I think in business, probably any area of business, you know, that can be difficult to see kind of beyond what's limiting you at that moment.
Yeah, I'm sure. How did people who were close to you react to your decision to go teach in Siberia?
I thought I was insane.
I can only imagine.
Yes. Actually, my boss was very funny. He said to me, man, you must really hate this job. So, you know, there was one person who had an idea of what I was going through. But I was pretty proficient at what I was doing as an attorney. So they actually gave me a year off. So my job was there if I wanted it when I came back.
Wow.
So that gave me, you know, a little cushion, you know, if I decided to continue with it. Ultimately I didn't, but, you know, massive credit to my former employer, Souls and Associates. They, you know, they bent over backwards for me, and frankly, they didn't have to do any of that. So it was a plus that maybe some other people don't have. But yeah, no, it was, there was a lot of what? You're going where? Even Russian people that I know in the US were saying the same thing. So it was fairly humorous.
Yeah, particularly if they were immigrants to the US, they were probably like, we tried hard to get out of there. What are you doing going back to where we left?
Well, it wasn't even just that I was going to Russia, but going to that particular city. You know, the closed cities had quite a reputation. So, you know, once communism fell, most of the funding for those cities disappeared or was greatly reduced. So when I was there, we didn't have hot water in the summer. You know, it didn't matter. It was very warm, but, you know, there were all kinds of little things like that. But, the cities were just out in the middle of nowhere because for strategic reasons from a military perspective, you know, they didn't want them close to other cities. They didn't want them, in areas, you know, where they could be easily accessible. So we were definitely way out in the middle of nowhere, but it was one of the best years of my life. I loved it. It was a great reset.
So how did that experience give you perspective in terms of what you do now, helping clients deal with issues of risk and reward?
You know, for me, it was, you know, the question with law, it's often the same thing you see in the medical profession where, you know, you're practicing in areas that greatly influence, you know, the lives of your clients. And so there are really two approaches to it. One is to become heavily emotionally involved, which is the approach I tended to take, or to just become kind of numb to it. and carry on. So with oncologists who treat cancer, one of the ironic things with oncologists is typically you want to try to get a young oncologist if you're dealing with a cancer situation, because they're still enthusiastic. An oncologist has been practicing for 40 years or something of that sort, has lost a lot of patients, not because of any, incompetence or anything, but it's just cancer and that's going to happen. And so you can lose that emotional attachment there, maybe the enthusiasm. It can be, difficult to understand that people. Same thing with attorneys. I had taken the emotional side of it. And so I knew it couldn't really become numb. So it was a question of how was I going to continue forward, but control that so it didn't eat me alive, at night if I lost a case or something of that sort. And that's how I kind of shifted more towards the planning stage and seeing, trying to pick up clients. I pick up clients of all size, but really, I look at them from the idea of, how can I help them grow? What are areas that they're doing that maybe if they went about it a different way, they might see, better potential and those kinds of things. So that was really the focus that I decided on. Some days the job isn't great, but other days, and quite a few days it is. And most of my clients have been with me for more than a decade, which is pretty shocking for attorneys. We typically don't keep clients that long. And it's, I've had an ability to watch some of them, go from their working in their garages to, taking down a floor of a commercial building now and beyond. And that's rewarding to see that and to see, that people are realizing their dreams.
I'm sure it's very rewarding. And what kinds of issues do you typically deal with?
It's everything in internet law, copyright, infringements, sort of a huge one at the moment. Privacy is becoming a big issue, terms and conditions, these types of things. Basically, the internet is it's kind of its own medium, its own environment from a legal perspective, but we have all these laws that have been around for centuries, and the question is, how do they apply to this new medium? And the other issue that we have is the beauty of the World Wide Web is it's worldwide, so you can reach a vast audience. The downside that we're starting to see now is that countries are starting to try to claim their space, if you will, on the web by passing different laws, and sometimes these laws conflict. So my goal and my approach is basically to look at a client's business and say, okay, well, here's what you're doing. Here are some legal issues that you have. Here's the most important ones that I would be concerned about that need to be addressed right away. And then, you can prioritize down the list based on budget and timing and, how critical the situation is. And what you find is that if you're proactive like that, it doesn't eliminate the potential lawsuits, but you can greatly reduce them, not only because of the legal work done, but because most of the competitors, may not be in compliance with many of the laws that they need to be in compliance in. So they're a much easier target should somebody come along that wants to pursue them. So the goal for me is, I talk with my clients maybe once a month, unless something dramatic is going on. But it's always, let's make the small change to try to position you so that, your risk online is limited and you can go focus on building your business. And that's generally the approach.
What kinds of mistakes do business owners commonly make when it comes to the internet?
They wing it, which isn't surprising, but in the year 2000, through 2005, perhaps, you could do that. And there really weren't any rules, that were specific to the web in the sense that we think of traditional business law, simply because it was early in the process and a lot of laws hadn't been passed. Even laws that had been passed, such as the Copyright Act that applies to an online environment called the DMCA, the courts are still trying to figure out how to apply it and, how do you form a contract online, all these kinds of issues. The problem that we see now is people go out and they use forms or form generators, or they copy forms from other sites. And, the business environment online is just really evolved past that. So, for instance, the terms and conditions for something like a dating site are simply just dramatically different than the terms and conditions for a social media site. There's just different legal issues that you have to address. And so you'll see people that use these and then they get sued for something. And, you look at the terms and, they stole them from some other company. They don't even have their own company's name on it. And it kind of goes downhill quickly from there. So those are big issues. The other big issue, really the top one's probably always copyright. People don't understand, copyright and the concept of copyright infringement. And the web, in their defense, makes it a little difficult because, I don't know if you remember, but prior to the internet, we never really shared information as businesses. We were very, trade secrets were a big issue. And then as the web has come along, you know, sharing is kind of the foundational basis for that. People share stuff right and left. You know, that's what Facebook and Twitter and everything is. And so then the questions are, you know, how do you deal with copyright in those situations? If somebody steals all of your content or something of that sort. So I deal with that issue a lot. People, what I see with people who come to me new is they'll have content from somewhere and they don't have a license to use it. And either they've received a nasty letter from somebody like Getty Images, you know, demanding $5,000 and take the image down, or they've, you know, had some other issue that's come up, or somebody has stolen their content. And so copyright's probably the primary issue that we look at.
So what are the things that business owners need to think about when it comes to copyright?
Well, you need to think about whenever you have something up on your site or your app, or you're going to put it up, you need to think about, where did I get this? And, you know, do I have the right to use it? Now, in a perfect world, you would create all your own content. The value of content really comes down to, you know, the uniqueness of it. So swiping articles and things from other sites, you know, there may be an occasion where that's, you know, worth doing, but most sites you want to have original content. So if you have original content, you know, and you hire a freelancer to shoot images or something of that sort, you want to make sure the copyright is transferred to you. If you have an employee in-house who created it, or you created it yourself, then you automatically own the copyright and it's not an issue. But then if you go out and you see something on another site that you want to use, you know, you need to have a basis and understanding as to whether you can use it and under what conditions. So if you go to YouTube, for instance, and you see a video that, let's say, you work in an area where a government agency issues regulations, and let's say the FTC, and the FTC has put out a video on something, you know, you need to look at that video and see if you can copy it to your site. And the way you can tell on YouTube is there will often be a share button with a link. And if that appears, then that person who posted that video has given you the right to share it. So you can use that. If that link doesn't appear, you can't just take the video, copy it, and put it up on your site. So you need to, you know, business owners need to have an understanding of that. And typically with my clients, I sit down with them in the first week or two and just go through it and show them examples and create a checklist for either themselves or their team. Because if they can eliminate the potential for copyright infringement, you know, it's just a huge step. The second issue that comes up all the time is we're now an interactive digital society, which means you know, practically every site, practically every app allows users to submit something. It may be comments, maybe a review of a product or service, maybe images like on a dating site. You know, you're allowing them to submit something. And in that situation, you know, the business wants to comply with something called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It was enacted in 1998. And what the act basically says is that if you are a website or an internet connected app, you cannot be held liable for copyright infringement based on content uploaded by your users. So the DMCA was passed in 1998. At that time, the internet was, you know, in its infancy. So if you think about Facebook, Facebook didn't exist, search engines, you know, what have you. They were trying to create an environment where companies would be able to not only start up but grow without getting swamped by copyright infringement lawsuits. And so this law was created. So if you think about Facebook, there's 1.4 billion users or whatever it is. There's no way Facebook can monitor all of that. And there's no way they would be able to determine if something is, you know, copyright infringement or not. So they comply with the DMCA. And if a copyright owner sees their content up on Facebook, they can file a complaint with Facebook. The complaint goes in, Facebook looks at it, immediately takes down the content, tells the person who posted the content, hey, we received a complaint for this image or whatever it is. You know, you have a right to file a counter notice. It almost never happens because the person, you know, didn't realize they were infringing. And that's the end of it. If the person files a counter notice, then they can go to court and have the full-blown infringement lawsuit, but it's between the person who posted the content and the copyright holder. Facebook is not involved. And so you don't have to be Facebook. Any business can take advantage of this law. It's a huge – it's a the proverbial get-out-of-card, you know, get-out-of-jail card for monopoly. I mean, it's a huge law. So if you own a business, you always have to think about copyright because you really want to protect yourself. Copyright is by far the single most common legal claim online. So always think those through. And then if somebody steals your content, you can use the DMCA to go file complaints with other sites about, you know, to get your content taken down.
I hope you're enjoying our show today. Would you like to learn how to minimize the most common risks associated with doing business on the internet? Join our free Smashing the Plateau community, where listeners and guests of Smashing the Plateau connect, collaborate, and learn how to smash the plateau in business, work, and in life. Go to smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook to join now. That's www.smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook. Now, Richard, for business owners that may not be sure that they have addressed these kinds of issues adequately, can they go to an attorney they're currently using, or can they go to an attorney they know but they're not yet using, or should there be somebody like you with a particular specialty in order to help reduce the risk in these areas?
I think if you're going to run an internet business, or you're taking your brick and mortar business and launching an internet side of it, then you certainly want to talk to an internet lawyer. Internet law, there really isn't anything called internet law. What it is it's a combination of other laws. And so an internet lawyer is going to be familiar with how courts have decided cases related to the online environment, what's allowed, what's not allowed. I'll give you an example. So it used to be that you would go to a site, and you still see it all the time. You go to a site, and if you scroll all the way to the bottom, you'll see a link on the bottom that says terms and conditions. That link's useless. It has no legal effect. It used to 10 years ago. A site used to be able to say, well, the terms and conditions bind the user. So the terms and conditions are simply a contract with your visitors. And what it's doing is it's covering issues, basic issues, that come up in copyright and other things. And it's tilting all of those issues in your favor as a business. So if you use Apple products, for instance, all the time you go onto iTunes or something like that, and they're always asking you to agree to their new terms because they're always updating their terms. They're doing that to reflect cases. Now, you don't, as a business, don't need to update that much. Apple's dealing with multi-jurisdictional issues and all kinds of different things, but they're doing that because it's important. So as a business, if you think about when you go out and you buy liability insurance for your business or health insurance or something like that, you have no ability to negotiate those terms. You can shop by price and what have you, but when they give you, the policies, you're kind of stuck with it. Well, this is your chance to be on the other side. So with those terms and conditions, you can tilt the battlefield in your favor. And that's why you want to have an attorney do them that's familiar with them. Once you do those, however, judges in the year 2000 weren't familiar with the web, couldn't set up their own email or anything of that sort. We've advanced forward 17 years, and now judges are. These judges have grown up with the internet. They've been using them for a decade or more, and they know full well that nobody scrolls to the bottom of the page and clicks that terms and conditions link. And so what we've seen over the last 10 years is the law change. And what the law has basically said is we are only going to enforce terms and conditions against users if you can show, you the business can show, that the user affirmatively agreed to those terms. And the way that manifests is you have to get the user to check a box saying, I agree to the terms and conditions. And you see this on sites and everything these days, or press a button, whatever it is. But they have to take an affirmative act, and it essentially is the signature on a contract, if you think of it that way. If that doesn't occur, it's a very rare case where they will actually enforce those terms. So that's a kind of a change in the law. A business lawyer or an attorney in another discipline really wouldn't know about those issues. And that's why some attorneys will still, put the links in the bottom of a site when there is an opportunity to force a user to check. So, for instance, a blog where they're just going to read, you can't really force them to agree to the terms because there's no proactive act they have to take. Whereas with a store, they have to go through the checkout process, or with any kind of membership site, they have to sign up. So you still see some people put those up. So as a business, what you want to do is, find an internet lawyer. You can do a search on, your favorite search engine. See candidates and then run them through Yelp typically is a good idea. And you'll see what other clients say about them and get a feel for that. If it's California, obviously you can call me, but in other states, you really want to stick kind of to your state because there can be state laws that will apply as well. And then just go in and sit down with the attorney, let them see your site, your app, whatever you're doing, give them, sit with them for an hour or so. And what they can do is create a list of different things that you need if you need anything. And then you can prioritize the risk factor of it. What it's going to cost to fix, and then just, work through it. And the beauty, again, is that once you work through that list, most of your competitors probably are not compliant. So if a plaintiff's attorney is looking at two sites, one is yours that's compliant, one is a competitor that's not compliant, they're going to go after the competitor.
Richard, if I were to ask you to look at maybe the top few actionable steps that business owners can take to address the most common risks that are out there with regard to internet legal issues, what would you say those steps are?
Well, the first step we've already discussed really is copyright. Look at your site, make sure everything that's on your site that you have the right to use it, and you need to have a specific reason why. Mm-hmm. So assuming you have that, you're in good shape. The second one is kind of an odd one. Make sure your insurance covers the type of claims that would arise regarding your site. So your site, if you're providing services, you might need errors and omissions coverage. If you're selling products, you know, you might need product liability. Don't assume that, you know, a general liability policy is going to cover what you're going to do. And typically what you can do with that is just hand it off to your attorney and tell them, you know, here's my site, here's what I do. Does this cover me? Do I need anything else? Insurance industry lags far behind modern technology. So a lot of times the policies aren't great and you need to adjust to do that, make sure that you have something in place there. Third thing is use that check the box function. Again, your terms and conditions and your privacy policy, but particularly your terms and conditions, they're ammunition for you. They help you as a business. Most people look at them, roll their eyes, or they don't want to deal with them. Those are for your benefit. So if you have them done correctly and drafted correctly, they can really save your bacon. I'll give you an example. With a big company, Google. Google was sued in New York for some claims related to one of their old failed social media platform efforts. And the claim involved a number of plaintiffs in New York, and Google had a clause in their terms and conditions that said, if you want to sue us, you have to come to California to do it. It's called a choice of forum clause. It's a very basic clause in nearly every contract now. And the court upheld that. And so the lawsuit technically had to be moved to California, and the plaintiffs in New York didn't move to California. And the lawsuit didn't move forward for that simple reason, because that was in their terms and conditions. And the reason it didn't move was that the plaintiff's attorney in New York had a personal beef with Google, and the case wasn't that great, wasn't that strong. But, you know, when they looked at moving it to California, they just made an investment decision, return on investment, that, you know, wasn't worth doing that. Now, obviously, you know, with a smaller business, you can use the same kind of clauses. The other clause that's come up that's huge is the United States Supreme Court. The big issue with the Supreme Court is always, what's the majority? Is the majority consist of conservative justices or liberal justices? Traditionally, it's been liberal. However, in the last decade or so, we've seen a twist more towards conservative, not completely, but it's gone in that general direction. In 2011, the Supreme Court cited a case called AT&T Mobility versus Concepcion. In that case, the Concepcions were a couple. They had purchased a smartphone contract with AT&T, and AT&T included a mandatory arbitration and class action waiver clause in there. And basically, prior to this case, AT&T really hadn't been allowed to do that. Businesses could not force consumers into arbitration. The reason is arbitration is more favorable to businesses. You tend to get a better result because your case is being heard by retired judges or attorneys and not juries. So they tend not to get emotionally inflamed, and they understand, you know, technical legal arguments a little bit better. Historically, that's not been allowed. The Supreme Court had always said it was a state rights issue, and nearly every state had said businesses cannot do this. So the surprise of everybody, the new conservative Supreme Court said, actually, it's a federal issue, and a federal law known as the Federal Arbitration Act of 1925. So we're going back a bit. Controlled, and all the state law was invalidated. And so now when you have a website, or even if you're offline, you know, you want to push mandatory arbitration clauses into your contracts, whether it's terms and conditions of a website or it's just the conditions of any old contract that you're signing with consumers in the brick and mortar world, because you can force them into arbitration, you're going to get a better result. The other aspect of that is you can force them to waive their class action rights. And a class action lawsuit is a very expensive lawsuit. And basically what it is you have, let's say you have a single product and you have a default with that product. So a defect with it. So let's say, you know, we're selling a radio or something and the radio shocks people. Okay. Well, an individual claim may not be worth that much money, but altogether, if you have 10,000 people who have been hurt by it, that's a big claim. Under this new ruling, the Concepcion ruling, you can force people to bring individual actions instead of grouping together. And the fact, simple fact is, most of them won't. So you save a ton of money as a business. So these are the kinds of things that you want to look at. But if you add those to your terms and conditions, you get custom terms for your site, you can dramatically limit your chance of being sued. And ultimately, that's really kind of what most businesses are looking at. When people contact me all the time, one of the questions they have is, how do I avoid being sued? And, you know, unfortunately, the truth is people can just go down and file a lawsuit for a couple hundred bucks. And otherwise sane people will do it. There was a judge on the East Coast who sued a laundromat for $100 million for ruining his trousers. A judge. You know, and obviously he eventually lost the case, and I think he was disbarred. But that was a judge. So, you know, you're going to have to deal with these issues. So the idea is to try to make things as tilted in your advantage as possible. And so, you know, making sure you have custom terms is incredibly important.
Thank you. Those are great tips. Richard, whom do you know personally who's been really successful at smashing plateaus?
You know, the one person that I think I would mention is probably Pat Flynn. He's a blogger online. You can read his story on his site. It's smartpassiveincome.com. Pat was an architect, and I believe it was 2008 when we had the massive downturn, and he was laid off, and he ended up launching an online business. I think it was course-oriented, but he's ultimately become extremely successful. And so for him, it was interesting because his act of smashing the plateau was more of a involuntary act. You know, he lost his job. But obviously it turned out to have a huge silver lining because he's doing incredibly well. He's well-known and speaking at most of the conventions and very, very successful. And he's also very transparent on his blog. So I think he would be the person that I would most point to.
Sounds great. And what can we look forward to in the near future from you? What's coming up?
You know, the only thing I really have coming up right now is we're launching a DMCA agent service. So DMCA is the copyright law that applies online. And under that law, when you're complying with the process like we discussed with Facebook earlier, you have to designate an agent to receive copyright complaints. A lot of people don't like listing their name and their phone number and email address online. So they look around for agents. And so we've launched an Indian agent service. You can find it at dmcaagentservice.com. And if you mention Smashing Plateau, I'll certainly give you a 20% discount on the first year. It's a $70 a year fee. We act as your agent so you don't get spammed to death and get a million sales calls from people who scraped your phone number off of your website.
Sounds great. Well, Richard, thank you so much for taking the time to join us on Smashing the Plateau. In addition to your new service, how can listeners learn more about you and follow you?
You can always reach me at my website. It's SoCal, like Southern California, SoCalInternetLawyer.com. You can look me up by my last name, Chapo, C-H-A-P-O. There aren't very many of us online. However, there was a large Mexican drug dealer who went by the nickname Chapo. That's not me. So if you do search by my name and you see listings from the DEA and the FBI, that also isn't me.
Sounds great. Well, Richard, thanks again for taking some time to speak with us about some really important issues for business owners. My guest today has been Richard Chapo, attorney with the Law Office of Richard A. Chapo. Thank you again, Richard, for joining us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to Smashing the Plateau. I hope you enjoyed our discussion today. Would you like to learn how to minimize the most common risks associated with doing business on the internet? Join our free Smashing the Plateau community, where listeners and guests of Smashing the Plateau connect, collaborate, and learn how to smash the plateau in business, work, and in life. Go to smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook to join now. That's www.smashingtheplateau.com/Facebook. We want you to smash the plateau in business, work, and in life.